Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Jim, it was just a couple of weeks ago, I guess, when Rick Santorum dropped out that we said that Mitt Romney's got a lot of work to do in some of these battleground states, and he still does. But some of the most recent polling, I believe it's from Quinnipiac, shows that he's already caught up and might even be just a smidge ahead. He's within the margin of error in both Florida and Ohio. He's still statistically behind in Pennsylvania, I think by 7 points, as you point out in the Jolt today. And so after coming off a pretty bruising primary and having a lot of time still to introduce himself to the American people who weren't paying that close of attention in the primaries, I think he's caught up pretty well.
Yes, Greg, this is a good martini. It is not a great martini. And what it tells us is that this election is pretty much where we think it's going to be. You're going to see a lot of polling data between now and November. Gallup is doing its tracking poll. There is a little bit of a panic in my world of conservative bloggers when, for seemingly no reason, Obama went from behind up by like 6 or 7 within a couple of days. And it lasted for a while. And last I checked, Romney was up by 1. So you saw a big poll bump for Obama seem to appear for no reason, and a big poll drop for Obama for no reason. This is in the Gallup tracking poll. What Quinnipiac is telling us today is pretty much what we would expect, which is to say Florida's a swing state, and Obama's probably going to have a particularly tough time there with, you know, deep troubles in the economy and gas prices in the housing market, the foreclosure rate, all things going on down in Florida. Ohio is going to be very close. It's kind of reassuring to see Romney kind of, you know, getting the numbers back there. And Pennsylvania is going to be a swing state, but a Democratic-leaning one. And it's one of those things where if Romney wins Pennsylvania, then, you know, the race is pretty much over. But no Republican should have any illusions about how difficult that will be. This is a state where there's still a lot of reliable Democratic voters in Philadelphia and in some parts of Pittsburgh. And the swing counties around Philadelphia are going to be the traditional battleground. This is how this is going to shake out. That's kind of normal. So we'll see how this plays out. But this is a reassuring to say, no, Obama is not somehow defying gravity. In fact, you're starting to see some pollsters noting that actually, when you look at the state of the economy, when you look at the historical rate of where presidents are, Obama should be doing much worse. So it says something about his personal likability, and or maybe people are kind of, you know, grading him on a curve. But there's a lot of room for Obama to fall, so to speak, in his poll numbers.
Are they grading him on a curve, Jim? Because I don't know if you know about this, but he inherited the crisis.
Ah, yes. He may have mentioned that. He should say that more often. It would, there may be 2 or 3 Americans who have not heard him say that personally.
Right. He needs to go door to door. Anyway, probably on the taxpayer dollar because it's not really a campaign trip. Anyway, on to martini number two now. Fresh off of his surprise trip to Afghanistan, the president, I think, is back in the country now. But he's got another little bit of a foreign policy problem on his hands here. And this one comes from China. Secretary of State Clinton, Secretary of the Treasury Geithner, over in China, supposedly talking about trade. But just before they went over there, the Chinese dissident, Chen Guangcheng, if I'm saying that correctly, a longtime critic of the Chinese government for its forced abortion and sterilization policy related to the one-child policy. He's been falsely imprisoned under house arrest, somehow broke out, got to the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, where it looked like the U.S. was in a great position, especially with Clinton coming to the country, to help out in some way. It's hard to know exactly what they could have done. It's pretty difficult sometimes in diplomatic circles. But according to Chen himself, basically, American officials took him to a hospital and left him there. And so that was the extent of the U.S. help since he was injured in the escape. Now he is very fearful for his life. Apparently his wife's been beaten as a result of his escape. He wants out of the country along with his wife, and apparently he's not getting much help from us.
You know, Greg, let's observe that this is a circumstance in which there are not a lot of good or easy decisions because we owe about $1 billion of debt to the Chinese. The Chinese tend to take these things very, very seriously. They are embarrassed by their dissidents. There's a part of me that is still very proud as an American that when a dissident wants to escape, wants a better life, they still come to America. Having said that, it appears that we certainly, you know, told everyone what they wanted to hear and then handed him back to the Chinese. And he, you know, may be in a circumstance in which the very best thing he can do is make as big of a hullabaloo, get as much attention as possible to make himself too important to just disappear into some Chinese prison somewhere. It is a grim situation. It certainly appears like we sold him out, or at the very least did not take every step to ensure his security. It's a delicate diplomatic situation, so I have a certain amount of sympathy for our ambassador and everybody else out there. But this is a circumstance in which this administration has not emphasized human rights as much as the Bush administration has. And we may be seeing a just vivid and kind of unnerving example of just how de-emphasized human rights is in the Obama foreign policy agenda.
On to martini number three now. Unfortunately, we get to end with a little levity. It's a tough call on the third martini today. We almost went with Obama's composite girlfriend, but since that had been revealed to some extent in the past, we decided to go with part two now of the Elizabeth Warren saga. She, of course, is the crusader for fairness. She was the president's first choice to lead the Consumer Financial Protection Outfit. The Senate wouldn't take that up, thanks to the Republicans. So now she's challenging Scott Brown for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts. And a couple of days ago, we talked about how she got busted, basically claiming to be Native American on her teaching applications and in various academic journals. Turns out she's 132nd Cherokee Indian. And so the Brown campaign seizing on that, basically saying she traded on a very scant part of her ethnicity to perhaps gain favor and advance in her profession. Elizabeth Warren apparently is not good at damage control, Jim, because we've got a couple of answers that she has here. First of all, she says, quote, "I listed myself in the directory in the hopes that it might mean that I would be invited to a luncheon, a group something that might happen with people who are like I am." The grammar there is, first of all, horrible. Secondly, I'm not sure there's a lot of 132nd Cherokee Indian clubs out there, so I'm not sure who she thought was going to invite her. Her only defense here is that Scott Brown is a misogynist and doesn't believe that she was qualified to do her job unless she claimed she was a minority status, even though she's the one who claimed that. And now here's my personal favorite claim of how this all unfolded.
My Aunt B has walked by that picture at least 1,000 times, remarked that her father, my papa, had high cheekbones like all of the Indians do, because that's how she saw it. And she said, "And your mother got those same great cheekbones, and I didn't." She thought this was the bad deal she had gotten in life.
Jim, if a Republican talked about, in general, the high cheekbones of Native Americans, do you think this would get the free pass from the media? Huh. And secondly, I'm shocked that if Aunt B didn't get this right, at least Andy, Opie, or Floyd the Barber would have told her that racial stereotyping is not a good thing.
I was about to say, Greg, basically, is she saying all Native Americans look alike?
I think so.
I marvel at this. Well, first of all, I'm going to adopt a line you used yesterday. Somewhere Martha Coakley is saying, boy, is she an amateur. Man, oh, man, you know. She just didn't have my touch with the common people. I was thinking about, is there any way Elizabeth Warren could salvage this? So this is a big, embarrassing moment, and she just kind of sounds ridiculous and looks ridiculous, and it's just, you know, flailing. I wonder if there's a way of her could have said, look, you know, we all know how the game is played. I didn't invent the game. I have this, you know, part of my ancestry. Why shouldn't I use it? Why should, you know, like, she could have done that, but instead now she was like, look, if you're laughing at me, you're sexist. The way this equation works is that Elizabeth Warren is always the victim, no matter what. No matter what she does, no matter what the circumstances, she's always the victim. I think this is going to make her look, you don't see a lot of people reflexively defending her on this. I think she looks ridiculous doing this. And the most people can say is, oh, can't we move on to serious issues like the blouse cost of Ann Romney or something like that, or you know, the Buffett rule, or, you know, let's get off the silly talk of Obama eating dogs and onto the serious talk of Mitt Romney putting the carrier on top of the car, you know. We'll see if this ends up moving the poll numbers. I'd have a hard time believing this wouldn't move the poll numbers at all in Massachusetts. I don't know if it'll make a dramatic swing. And we'll see what happens. I think that she doesn't look like quite the astute, easygoing person. She looks kind of brittle and silly and ridiculous and flailing at this point. And that's good news for Scott Brown.
Yeah, utterly pathetic. She could have just easily said, this is what my family told me, so I assumed it was true. Instead, she just went through all these pathetic explanations and excuses and like you said, blame shifting onto Scott Brown. Like it's his fault that she lied all those years, either intentionally or unintentionally. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us on Friday for the next Three Martini Lunch.